Chapter 19. I am sorry, Kale, Geryon told his friend as they sat together in Geryon's study. The morning sun was streaming golden through the window as he spoke. But I have to have you and your brothers here at Riva. I am taking most of our forces with me, and someone has to stay here to defend the city in case some of the cultists' ships slip around behind us. Kale's face was angry. That's not the real reason, is it? Not entirely, no, Geryon admitted. I know how much you all loved your father, and I know how much you want revenge on the people responsible for his murder. Well, isn't that only natural? Of course it is. But people caught up in those feelings don't think clearly. They get rash and do things that put them in danger. Your family has shed enough blood already. First your brother Olban, then Errol, and now your father. So I'm not taking any chances with the rest of you. Kale stood up, his face red with suppressed anger. Does your majesty have any further instructions for me? Geryon sighed. No, Kale, not at the moment. You know what to do here. Yes, your majesty. Kale bowed curtly, turned and left the room. Belgarath came into Geryon's study through the other door. He didn't like it.
I didn't think he would.
The old man shrugged, scratching at one bearded cheek.
But he is too important here, in the Citadel, for us to be risking his life. He will be angry for a while, but he'll get over it.
Is Aunt Paul staying behind, too? Belgarath made a face.
No. She insists on going. At least the other ladies have sense enough to realize that a battlefield is no place for a woman. I think we are to leave Arant here, too. He has no sense of personal danger, and that is not a good trait when the fighting starts. You had better finish here. The morning's tide is turning, and we are almost ready to start.
As the Seabird moved out of the harbor that sunny morning, with a flotilla of stout Riven ships following her, Geryon and the others gathered in the spacious, low-beamed aft cabin, poring over maps and discussing strategy.
"The inlet that runs up to Jarvik'sholm is very narrow," Unhag advised them.
Barak added,
"And then those catapults on top of the cliffs will sink half of the fleet."
"Is there any way we can come to the city from behind?" Hetar asked.
"There's a road coming up from Halberg," Barak replied. "But it goes through several passes, 15 leagues or so to the south of the city. Those passes are ideal for ambushes."
General Brendig had been studying the map.
"What's this terrain like?"
he asked, pointing at a spot on the south side of the mouth of the inlet.
"Rough and steep."
"That is a description of most of Kerik," Silk observed.
"Is it passable?"
Brendig persisted.
"Oh, you could climb it, but you'd be in plain view of the catapultists up on the cliffs. There's a whole army waiting for you by the time you get to the top."
"Not if you did it at night," Brendig said.
"At night?"
the big man scoffed.
"Brendig, do you really want to take up nighttime mountain climbing at your age?"
Brendig shrugged.
"If it's the only way to get there."
Mandarallan had also been studying the map.
"Prithee, my lord," he said to Barak, "is this slope to the north also gentle enough to afford access to the cliff top?"
Barak shook his head.
"It's a sheer face there."
"Then we must need seek other means to neutralize the catapults on that side."
The knight thought for a moment, and then he smiled.
"And we have the means at our immediate disposal."
"I'd be interested to know what they are, then," King Folrak said to him.
"It is the simplest possible solution, your majesty,"
Mandarallan beamed.
"To convey siege engines up the south slope would be tiresome, particularly during the hours of darkness. It would, moreover, be totally unnecessary,
since the means of destroying the engines on the north side are already in place.
I don't quite follow what you're suggesting, Garion admitted.
I do, Hetar said. All we have to do is climb the south slope at night, capture the catapults on top, and then start lobbing boulders at the engines across the inlet.
And once you distract those people, I can sweep up the inlet with fireboats and burn out the shipyards, Anheg added. Well, doesn't that still leave the city intact, then? King Folrak asked dubiously.
Garion stood up and began to pace up and down, thinking hard. Once we start throwing rocks back and forth across the inlet, and the fireboats start moving up toward the yards, it's going to attract quite a bit of attention from the city, wouldn't you say?
I could almost guarantee that, Brendig replied.
Then wouldn't that be a perfect time to mount an attack on the landward side of the town? Everybody's going to be lining the front wall. The back side will only be lightly defended. If we strike fast enough, we could be inside before most of the defenders knew we were coming.
Ah, oh, very good, Bergerian,
King Kohag murmured.
It's all going to have to be carefully timed, though, Beric said thoughtfully. We'll have to work out a way to pass the signals back and forth.
That is not really a problem, Beric, and Paul told the big man. We can take care of that.
You know, Anheg said, I think it might work. If we get lucky, we could take Jarviksholm in a single day.
I never cared much for long sieges anyway, Silk noted, carefully polishing one of his rings. 2 days later, they found the Kerik fleet standing at anchor off of the Halberg Straits, a narrow passage leading through a cluster of small rocky islets jutting up out of the coastal waters of the west coast of the Kerik Peninsula. The islets were topped with scrubby trees, and they stood out green against the snowfields covering the higher mountains. Garion stood at the rail of the Seabird, drinking in the beauty of the wild coast. A light step behind him and a familiar fragrance announced his Aunt Paul's approach.
It's lovely, isn't it, Garion?
Quite breathtaking.
It always seems this way. Somehow it's when you are on your way to something very ugly that you come across these glimpses of beauty.
She looked at him gravely.
You will be careful at Jarviksholm, won't you?
I'm always careful, Aunt Paul.
Really? I seem to remember a number of incidents not too many years ago.
But I was a child then.
But some things never change, I'm afraid.
She suddenly put her arms about his neck and sighed.
Oh, my Garion. I have missed you in the past few years, do you know that?
Well, I've missed you too, Aunt Paul.
Sometimes I wish...
He left it hanging.
That we could have just stayed at Faldor's farm.
You know, it really wasn't such a bad place, was it?
No, it was a very good place for a child. But you are grown now. Would you really have been content there? Life was quite placid at Faldor's.
If we hadn't left, I'd never have known what it was like to live any other way.
But if we hadn't left, you never would have met Zinedra, would you?
I suppose I hadn't thought about that.
Well, let's go below then, shall we? That breeze is really rather brisk.
They encountered King Anheg and Barak in a narrow companionway just outside the main cabin below decks.
Barak, Anheg was saying acidly, you're getting to be worse than an old woman. I don't care what you say, Anheg, the red-bearded Barak growled. You're not going to take the Seabird up that inlet until all of those catapults have been cleared. I didn't spend that much money on her to have somebody drop boulders on her decks from the cliffs. My boat, my rules.
The lean-faced javelin approached from down the companionway.
Is there some problem, my lords?
He asked.
I was just laying down a few rules for Anheg here, Barak replied. He's going to be in charge of my ship while I'm gone.
Were you going somewhere, my lord Trelheim?
I'll be going with Geryon when he mounts the attack on the city.
As you think best, my lord. How long do you think it's going to take to reach the mouth of the inlet?
Beric tugged at his luxuriant red beard.
Those Riven ships carrying Geryon's troops aren't quite as fast as our warships, he mused. I make it about a day and a half. Wouldn't you agree, Anhag?
About that?
Yes.
That should put us there tomorrow evening, then, Javelin asked.
Right. And that is when the fun will start.
Aunt Paul sighed.
Oh, Aelorns.
After a few shouted conferences from ship to ship, the combined fleet heeled over sharply in the quickening breeze and beat northward along the rugged west coast of the Kerrick Peninsula toward Jarviksholm. The following morning, Geryon went up on deck with Beric and Hetar to watch the sun coming up above the forested and snow-capped peaks of Kerrick. The shadows back in the wooded valleys were a kind of misty blue, and the sun sparkled on the waves. A mail-shirted Kerrick sailor, who had been ostensibly coiling a rope, turned from his task, then suddenly plunged a dagger directly at Geryon's unprotected back as the king stood at the rail. The attack might well have proved fatal, had Durnak not shouted a quick warning. Geryon half-turned in time to see the dagger go skittering across the deck. At the same time, he heard a startled exclamation and a splash. He wheeled about to see a desperately clutching hand sinking beneath the waves about 30 yards to port. He looked questioningly at Polgara, but she shook her head.
"I forgot about that metal shirt," Durnak said apologetically. "Sort of hard to swim with one of those on, isn't it?"
"More than sort of," Beric assured him.
"You'll want to question him, I suppose," Durnak said. "I could fish him out if you'd like."
"What do you think, Hetar?"
Hetar considered the notion for several moments, looking out at the bubbles coming up from somewhere far beneath the surface.
"These are Kerrick waters, aren't they?"
Beric nodded.
"Then I think we should consult King Anhag and get his opinion."
"Anhag's sleeping late this morning," Beric told him, also looking out at the bubbles.
"I would hate to wake him. He has had a lot on his mind lately, and I am sure that he needs his rest."
The tall Algar turned to Durnak with an absolutely straight face.
"I will tell you what, Durnak. The very moment King Anhag wakes up, we will bring the matter immediately to his attention."
"Have you ever translocated anything before, Durnak?"
Polgara asked her husband.
"No, not really. I knew how it was done, of course, but I've never had occasion to try it myself. I threw him just a little farther than I'd intended to, I'm afraid."
But you'll get better with practice, dear," she assured him. Then she turned to Geryon. "Are you all right?"
"I'm fine, Aunt Paul. He didn't even get close to me, thanks to Durnak."
"He's always been very useful to have around," she replied, giving Durnak a warm smile.
"Where did that fellow come from, Beric?"
"Val Alwyn, of all places. He always seemed like a good man, too. He did his work and kept his mouth shut. I would never have suspected that he might have had a religious conviction."
"Maybe it is time for us to examine everybody's feet."
Beric looked at him quizzically.
"If Silk is right, then all of the bear cultists have that brand on the soles of their feet. It's probably easier in the long run to examine the feet rather than have Geryon offer his back to every dagger aboard your ship."
"You might be right," Beric agreed.
They sailed into the wide mouth of the inlet that wound its way up toward Jarviksholm just as the sun was setting.
"Shouldn't we have waited until after dark to come this close?"
Geryon asked, as he and the other kings stood on the foredeck of the Seabird. Onheg shrugged.
They knew we were coming. They've been watching us ever since we left the Halberg Straits. Besides, now that they know that we are here, those catapultists up there will concentrate on watching the ships. That ought to make it easier for you and Brendig to slip up behind them when the time comes.
Well, it makes sense, I guess. Barak came forward with one-armed General Brendig.
As close as we can figure it. We ought to start about midnight. Geryon and the rest of us will climb up first and circle around until we're behind the city. Brendig and his men can follow us up and start taking over the catapults. As soon as it gets light enough to see, he's going to start throwing boulders across the inlet.
Will that give Geryon time enough to get into position? King Thorak asked.
It should be plenty of time, Your Majesty,
Brendig assured him.
Lord Barak says that once we get to the top, the terrain is fairly flat.
There are the trees, too. That should give us plenty of concealment.
How much open space are we going to have to charge across when we attack the city?
Oh, maybe 500 yards.
Well, that's quite a ways.
It's about as far as I want to run.
Evening settled slowly over the calm waters of the inlet, purpling the sheer cliffs rising on either side. Geryon used the last bit of light carefully to examine every inch of the steep slope which he and his men would be climbing in just a few hours. A flicker of movement just overhead caught his eye, and he looked up in time to see a ghostly white shape sliding silently through the calm purple air. A single soft white feather slowly sifted down to settle on the deck not far away.
Gravely,
Hetar went over and picked it up. A moment or two later, Aunt Paul, wrapped in her blue cloak, came down to the deck and joined them.
"You are going to have to be very careful when you approach the shipyards," she spoke to Anheg, who stood nearby with Brendig. "They have moved the catapults down to the beaches to try to hold you off."
"I expected that," he replied with an indifferent shrug. "You'd better pay attention to her, Anheg," Barak said in a threatening tone, "because if you get my ship sunk, I will pull out your beard one whisker at a time."
"What a novel way to address one's king," Silk murmured to Javelin. "How heavily is the rear of the city defended?" Geryon asked Bolgara.
"The walls are high, and the gate looks impressive. There aren't very many men there, though."
"Good." Hetar silently handed her the feather.
"My thank you. I would have missed that."
The slope of the hill leading to the rolling plateau high above was even steeper than Geryon's examination from the deck of the Seabird had led him to believe. Clumps of broken rock, almost invisible in the midnight darkness, rolled treacherously underfoot, and the stiff limbs of the scrubby bushes that choked the hillside seemed almost to push deliberately at his face and chest as he struggled upward. His mail shirt was heavy, and he was soon dripping with sweat.
"Rough going," Hetar observed laconically.
A pail of silver moonlight had risen when they finally crested that brutal slope. As they reached the top, they found that the plateau above was covered with a dense forest of fir and spruce trees.
"This might take us a little longer than I thought," Barak muttered, eyeing the thick undergrowth.
Geryon paused to get his breath.
"Well, let's stop for a moment then," he told his friends.
He stared glumly at the forest barring their way.
"If all of us start crashing through that, we're going to alert the catapultists along the top of the cliff. I think we'd better send out some scouts to see if we can find a path or track of some kind."
"Give me a while," Silk told him.
"You'd better take some men with you."
"They'd just slow me down. I'll be back before long."
The little man vanished into the trees.
"He never changes, does he?"
Hetar murmured. Barak laughed shortly.
"Did you really think that he would?"
"How long thinkest thou it will be until the dawn, my lord?"
Mandarallan asked the big Kerrick.
Two, maybe 3 hours. That hill, it took us a long time.
Laldoran, his bow slung across his back, joined them at the edge of the dark wood.
General Brendig has started up, he told them.
I wonder how he's going to manage that climb with only one arm.
I don't think you'll need to worry too much about Brendig. He usually does what he sets out to do.
He's a good man, Beric agreed.
They waited in the warm summer darkness as the moon slowly climbed the eastern sky. From far below, Geryon could hear the calls of Enhig's men and the rasp of windlasses as the sailors strove to make enough noise to cover any inadvertent sounds that Brendig's men might make as they struggled up that brushy slope. Finally, Silk returned, appearing soundlessly out of the bushes.
There's a road about a quarter of a mile south of here. It seems to go toward Jarviksholm.
Excellent, Mandarallan said gaily. Let us proceed, my lords. The city doth await our coming.
Oh, I hope not, Geryon said. The whole idea is to surprise them. The narrow road Silk had found proved to be a woodcutter's track, and it meandered in a more or less easterly direction, leading them inland. Behind him, Geryon could hear the jingle of mail shirts and the steady shuffling tread of his soldiers as they moved through the tag end of night and the deep shadows of the surrounding forest. There was a sense of inexorable purpose involved in this leading a mass of faceless men through the darkness. A tense excitement had been building in him since they had left the ships. His impatience to begin the attack was so strong now that it was all he could do to keep himself from breaking into a run. They reached a large cleared area. At the far side of that open field, the white ribbon of a well-traveled highway cut due north across the moonlit pastureland.
"That's the Harburg Road. We're almost there."
"I had better see how Brendig's doing," Geryon said. He carefully reached out, skirting the thoughts of the troops, massed at his back and seeking the familiar touch of Durnik's mind.
"Durnik," he said silently, "can you hear me?"
"Geryon?"
the smith's thought came back.
"Right. Have you captured the catapults yet?"
"Oh, we've still got a dozen or so to take. Brendig's moving slowly to keep down unnecessary noise."
"Will you have them all by the time it starts getting light?"
"I'm sure we will."
"Good. Let me know when you capture the last one."
"I will."
"How are they doing?"
Laldoran asked. The young bowman's voice was tight with excitement. "They'll be ready when it's time," Geryon replied.
"What thinkest thou, my lord?"
Mandarallan asked Beric.
"Might it not be the proper moment to select some few stout trees to serve as rams to reduce the city gates?"
"I'll deal with that," Geryon told him firmly.
Beric stared at him.
"You mean that you're going to..."
He made a gesture with one thick-fingered hand. Geryon nodded.
"That hardly seems proper, Geryon," Beric objected disapprovingly.
"Proper?"
"Well, there are certain ways that things are supposed to be done. City gates are supposed to be knocked in with battering rams."
"While the people inside pour boiling pitch down on the men trying to break in?"
"Well, that's part of the risk. Without a little risk, a battle isn't very much fun."
Hetar laughed quietly. "I hate to fly in the face of tradition," Geryon said, "but I am not going to let a lot of people get killed unnecessarily just for the sake of an old custom." A hazy ground fog, glowing in the moonlight, lay low on the broad, open expanse between the edge of the forest and the towering walls of Jarviksholm. Off to the east, the first pale glimmer of the approaching dawn stained the velvet sky. There were ruddy torches along the top of the heavy battlements of the city. By their light, Geryon could see a number of armed men.
"How close do you need to get to break the gate?" Silk whispered to Geryon.
"Well, the closer the better."
"All right. We'll have to move up a bit, then. The fog and the tall grass should help."
"I'll go along with you," Beric said.
Is it likely to make very much noise?
Probably, Geryon said. The big man turned to Hetar and Mandarallan.
You start as you signal. When Geryon knocks the gate down, you start the charge.
Hetar nodded. Geryon drew in a deep breath. All right, let's go. Crouched low, the three of them started across the open field toward the city. When they were no more than 100 yards from the gate, they sank down in the tall grass.
Geryon,
Durnik's thought came from out of the growing light.
We've captured all of the catapults.
Can you see the ones on the north cliffs yet?
Oh, it's probably going to be just a few more minutes, then.
Tell Brendig to start just as soon as he can make them out. They waited as the eastern sky grew steadily lighter. Then a series of solid thuds came from beyond the city, followed after an interval by the sound of heavy rocks crashing through timbers and by startled shouts and cries of pain.
We've started, Durnik reported.
Geryon, Polgara's thought came to him. Are you in position? Yes, Aunt Paul. We're going to start up the inlet now. Let me know when you're in sight of the city. Be careful, Geryon. I will.
What's happening?
Beric whispered, eyeing the men atop the city walls. They've started dropping rocks on the north cliff, Geryon replied softly. And Anheg's got the fleet moving. Beric ground his teeth together.
I told him to wait until all of the catapults were out of action.
Don't worry so much about the ship of yours, Silk murmured. It's very hard to aim a catapult when you're dodging boulders.
Somebody still might get lucky.
They waited tensely as the light slowly grew. Geryon could smell the salt tang of the sea and the heavy odor of evergreens as he surveyed the stout gate. We can see the city now, Geryon, Aunt Paul reported. Shouts of alarm came from inside the city, and Geryon saw the armed men atop the walls running along the parapet, making for the seaward side of Jarviksholm. Are we ready? He whispered to his two friends. Let's do it, Silk said tensely. Geryon rose to his feet and concentrated. He felt something that was almost like an inrushing of air as he drew in and concentrated his will. He seemed to be tingling all over as the enormous force built up in him. Grimly, he drew Iron Grip's sword, which he had left sheathed until now in order to conceal that telltale blue fire. The orb leaped joyously into flame. Here we go, he said from between clenched teeth. He pointed the sword at the gate, standing solid and impenetrable-looking 100 yards in front of him. Burst, he commanded, and all of his clenched-in will surged into the sword and ran out through its flaming tip. The one thing that he had overlooked, of course, was the orb's desire to be helpful. The force which struck the gates of Jarviksholm was, to put it very mildly, excessive. The logs disappeared entirely, and chunks and splinters of that tar-smeared gate were later found as much as 5 miles distant. The solid stone wall in which the gate had been mounted also blew apart, and many of the huge rough-hewn blocks sailed like pebbles to splash into the harbor and the inlet far from the city. Most of the back wall of Jarviksholm crumbled and fell in on itself, and the noise was awful.
Baelor,
Beric swore in amazement as he watched the nearly absolute destruction. There was a stunned silence for a moment, and then a great shout came from the edge of the woods as Hetar and Mandarallan led the charge of the masked Rivens and Kerix into the stunned city. It was not what warriors would call a good fight. The bear cult was not composed entirely of able-bodied men. It had also attracted into its ranks old men, women, even children. Because of the raging fanaticism of the cult, the warriors entering the city frequently found it necessary to kill those who might otherwise have been spared. By late afternoon, there were only a few small pockets of resistance remaining in the northwest quarter of Jarviksholm, and much of the rest of the city was on fire.
Geryon, half sickened by the smoke and the slaughter, stumbled back through the burning city over that shattered wall and out into the open fields beyond. He wandered, tired and sick for a time, until he came across Silk, seated comfortably on a large rock, casually watching the destruction of the city.
"Is it just about finished?" the little man asked.
"Yes, nearly," Geryon replied. "They only have a few buildings left in their control."
"How was it?"
"Unpleasant. A lot of old people and women and children got killed."
"Yes, that happens sometimes."
"Did Anheg say what he was going to do with the survivors? I think there's been enough killing already."
"It's hard to say. Our Kerik cousins tend sometimes to be a bit savage, though. Some things are likely to happen in the next day or so that you probably won't want to watch. Like that."
He pointed toward the edge of the wood where a crowd of Kereks were working on something. A long pole was raised and set into the ground. A cross piece was attached to the top of the pole, and a man was tied by his outspread arms to the crosspiece.
"No!"
Geryon exclaimed.
"I wouldn't interfere, Geryon. It is Anheg's kingdom, after all, and he can deal with traitors and criminals in any way that he sees fit."
"But that's barbaric."
"Moderately so, yes. As I said, though, Kereks have a certain casual brutality in their nature."
"But shouldn't we at least question the prisoners first?"
"Javelin is attending to that."
Geryon stared at the crowd of soldiers working in the last ruddy light of the setting sun.
"I'm sorry," he said, choking in revulsion. "But that is going entirely too far. I'm going to put a stop to it right now."
"I would stay out of it, Geryon."
"Oh, no. Not when he starts crucifying women."
"He's what?"
Silk turned to stare at the soldiers. Suddenly, the blood drained from the little man's face, and he sprang to his feet. With Geryon close on his heels, he ran across the intervening turf.
"Have you lost your mind entirely?"
he demanded hotly of the bony chief of Drasnian intelligence, who sat calmly at a rough table in the center of a group of soldiers.
"What seems to be a problem, Keldar?" "Do you know who that is that you just crucified?" "Naturally. I questioned her myself."
His fingers moved almost idly, but Silk stood directly in front of the table, cutting off Geryon's view of the thin man's hands.
"Get her down from there," Silk said, though his voice seemed for some reason to have lost the edge of its outrage. "Why don't you attend to your own business, Keldar?"
Javelin suggested.
"Leave me to mine."
He turned to a burly Kerik standing nearby.
"Prince Keldar and the Riven King will be leaving now," he said coldly. "Would you escort them, please? I think that they should be somewhere at least a quarter of a mile from here." "I will kill him,"
Silk fumed, as he and Geryon were herded away.
"I will kill him with my own bare hands."
As soon as the soldiers had led them to a spot some distance from Javelin and had turned to go back to their grisly work, the little man regained his composure with astonishing speed.
"What was all of that about?" Geryon asked.
"The girl he just crucified is his own niece, Lyselle,"
Silk replied quite calmly.
"You can't be serious."
"I have known her since she was a child. He promised to explain later." "His explanation had better be very good, though, or I am going to carve out his tripes."
He removed a long dagger from under his pearl-gray doublet and tested the edge with his thumb. It was after dark when Javelin came looking for them.
"Oh, put that away, Keldar," he said disgustedly, looking at Silk's dagger. "I may need it in a minute," Silk replied. "Start talking, Javelin, and you had better make it very convincing, or I'll have your guts in a pile right between your feet."
you seem upset. Oh, you noticed. How clever of you. I did what I did for a very specific reason. Wonderful. I thought you were just amusing yourself. I can do without that sarcasm, Silk. You should know by now that I never do anything without a reason. You can put your mind at rest about Lizelle. She is probably already released. Released? Escaped, actually. There were dozens of cultists hiding in those woods. Your eyes must be going bad on you if you didn't see them. Anyway, by now, every prisoner we crucified has been released and is on his way safely back to the mountains. Exactly what is this all about, Javelin? It's really very simple. We have been trying for years to get someone into the upper echelons of the Bear Cult. They have just rescued a genuine heroine, a martyr to the cause. Lizelle is clever enough to use that to work her way into their higher councils. How did she get here in the first place? Javelin shrugged. She put on a male shirt. And I slipped her on board Trelheim's ship. After the fighting was nearly over, I just slipped her in with the other prisoners.
Won't the others who were just rescued say that she was never in the city?
No, Your Majesty. I don't think so, Javelin replied. She's going to say that she lived in the northeast quarter of Jarviksholm. The others we crucified all came from the southwest quarter. Jarviksholm is a very good-sized town. Nobody could really say for sure that she wasn't there all along.
I still can't believe that you would actually do that to her.
It took a fair amount of convincing, and a great deal of fast talking on her part to persuade me,
Javelin admitted. Silk stared at him.
Oh, yes, Javelin said. Hadn't you guessed? The whole thing was her idea in the first place.
Suddenly, Geryon heard a hollow rushing sound, and a moment later Tenedra's voice came to him quite clearly.
Geryon! She cried out in anguish. Geryon, come home immediately! Someone has stolen our baby!
Chapter 20 Polgara looked at Geryon critically as they stood together in the high open meadow above the still-burning city of Jarviksholm, while the pale light of dawn washed the stars out of the sky.
"Your wing feathers are too short," she told him.
Geryon made the feathers longer.
Much better."
Then her look became intense, and she also shimmered into the shape of a speckled falcon.
"I've never liked these hard feathers," she murmured, clicking her hooked beak.
Then she looked at Geryon, her golden eyes fierce.
"Try to remember everything I told you, dear. We won't go too high on your first flight."
She spread her wings, took a few short steps with her taloned feet, and lifted herself effortlessly into the air. Geryon tried to imitate what she had just done, and drove himself beak first into the turf. She swooped back in.
"You have to use your tail, too, Geryon. The wings give the power, but the tail gives direction. Now try it again."
The second attempt was a bit smoother. He actually flew for about 50 yards before he crashed into a tree.
"That was very nice, dear. Just try to watch where you're going."
Geryon shook his head, trying to clear the ringing from his ears and the speckles of light from in front of his eyes.
"Straighten your feathers, dear, and let's try it again." "It's going to take months for me to learn this, Aunt Paul. Wouldn't it just be faster to sail to Riva on the seabird?" "No, dear. You just need a bit of practice, that's all."
His third attempt was somewhat more successful. He was beginning to get the knack of coordinating his wings and tail, but he still felt clumsy, and he seemed to do a great deal of clawing ineffectually at the air.
"Geryon, don't fight with it. Let it lift you."
They circled the meadow several times in the shadowless luminosity of dawn. Geryon could see the smoke rising black from the city, and the burned-out shipyards in the harbor as he followed Polgara in a steady upward spiral. As his confidence increased, he began to feel a fierce exhilaration. The rush of cool morning air through his feathers was intoxicating, and he found that he could lift himself higher and higher, almost effortlessly. By the time the sun was fully up, the air was no longer an enemy, and he had begun to master the hundreds of minute muscular adjustments necessary to get the greatest possible efficiency out of his feathers. Belgarath swooped in to join them, with Darnik not far behind.
"How's he doing?"
the fierce-looking falcon asked Polgara. "He's almost ready, father."
"Good. Let him practice for another 15 minutes or so, and then we'll get started. There is a column of warm air rising off that lake over there. That always makes it easier."
He tilted on one wing and veered away in a long, smooth arc.
"She's really very fine, Paul," Dernick said. "I should have learned how to do this years ago."
When they moved into the column of air rising from the surface of the warm waters of the lake, Geryon learned the secret of effortless flight. With his wings spread and unmoving, he let the air lift him up and up. Objects on the ground far below shrank as he rose higher and higher. Jarviksholm now looked like a toy village, and its harbor was thick with miniature ships. The hills and forests were bright green in the morning sunshine. The sea was azure, and the snowfields on the higher peaks were so intensely white that they almost hurt his eyes.
"How high would you say we are now?"
he heard Dernick ask Belgarath.
"Oh, several thousand feet. It's sort of like swimming, isn't it? Doesn't really matter how deep the water is, because you're only using the top of it anyway." "I've never really thought of it that way."
Belgarath looked over at Aunt Paul.
"This should be high enough," he said in his shrill falcon whistle. "Let's go to Riva."
The four of them beat steadily southwest, leaving the Kerik coast behind and flying out over the Sea of the Winds. For a time, a following breeze aided them, but at midday the breeze dropped, and they had to work for every mile. Geryon's shoulders ached, and the unaccustomed effort of flying made the muscles in his chest burn.
Grimly, he flew on.
Far below him he could see miles-long waves on the Sea of the Winds, looking from this height almost like ripples roughening the surface in the afternoon sunlight. The sun was low over the western horizon when the rocky coast of the Isle of Winds came into view. They flew southward along the east coast and spiraled down at last toward the uplifted towers and battlements of the citadel, standing grim and gray over the city of Riva. A sentry, leaning idly on his spear atop the highest parapet, looked startled as the four speckled falcons swooped in to land around him, and his eyes bulged with astonishment as they shimmered into human form.
"Your Majesty," he stammered to Geryon, awkwardly trying to bow and hold on to his spear at the same time.
"What happened here?" Geryon demanded.
"Someone abducted your son, sire," the sentry reported. "We have sealed off the island, but we haven't caught him yet."
"Well, let's go down," Geryon said to the others. "I want to talk to Tenedra." But that, of course, was nearly impossible. As soon as Geryon entered the blue-carpeted royal apartment, she flew into his arms and collapsed in a storm of hysterical weeping. He could feel her tiny body trembling violently against him, and her fingers dug into his arms as she clung to him.
"Tenedra," he pleaded with her, "you've got to stop. You have to tell us what happened."
"He's gone, Geryon," she wailed. "Somebody came into the nursery and took him."
And she began to cry again. Arianna, Laldoran's blonde membrane wife, stood not far away, and the dark-haired Adara stood at the window, looking on with a grieved expression.
"Why don't you see what you can do, Paul?"
Belgarath said quietly.
"Try to get her calmed down. I'll need to talk to her, but probably later. Right now, I think the rest of us should go to talk to Kael."
Polgara had gravely removed her cloak, folded it carefully, and laid it across the back of a chair.
"All right, father," she replied.
She came over and gently took the sobbing little queen out of Geryon's arms.
"It's all right, Zenedra. We're here now. We will take care of everything."
Zenedra clung to her.
"Oh, Lady Polkra,"
she cried.
"Have you given her anything?" Aunt Paul asked Arianna.
"Nay, my lady,"
the blonde girl replied.
"I fear that in her distraught condition, those potions which most usually have the calming effect might do her injury."
"Let me have a look at your medicine kit."
"At once, Lady Polkra."
"Come along,"
Belgareth said to Geryon and Durnik, a steely glint coming into his eyes.
"Let's go find Kale and see if we can get to the bottom of this."
They found Kale sitting wearily at a table in his father's office. Spread before him was a large map of the island, and he was poring over it intently.
"It happened sometime yesterday morning, Belgareth," he said gravely, after they had exchanged the briefest of greetings. "It was before daybreak. Queen Zenedra looked in on the prince a few hours past midnight, and everything was fine. A couple of hours later he was gone."
"What have you done so far?"
Belgareth asked him.
"I ordered the island sealed, and then we searched the citadel, from one end of it to the other. Whoever took the prince was nowhere in the fortress, but no ship has arrived or departed since I gave that order, and the harbor master reports that no one has sailed after midnight yesterday. So far as I know, the abductor has not left the Isle of the Winds."
"Good," Geryon said, a sudden hope welling up in him.
"At the moment, I have troops searching house by house in the city, and the ships are patrolling every inch of the coastline. The island is completely sealed off."
"Have you searched the forests and the mountains?"
the old man asked.
"We want to finish the search of the city first," Kale said. "Then we will seal the city and move the troops out into the surrounding countryside."
Belgareth nodded, staring at the map.
"We want to move carefully. Let's not back this child stealer into a corner. At least not until we have my great-grandson safely back where he belongs."
Kale nodded his agreement. "The safety of the prince is our primary concern." Polgara quietly entered the room.
"I gave her something that will make her sleep. And Arianna is watching her. I don't think it would do any good to try to question her just yet. And sleep is what she needs right now."
"You're probably right, Aunt Paul. But I'm not going to sleep. Not until I find what happened to my son."
Early the following morning, they gathered again in Kale's orderly study to pore once again over the map. Geryon was about to ask Kale about the search of the city, but he stopped as he felt a sudden tug of the great sword strapped across his back. Absently, still staring at the yellowed parchment map on Kale's desk, he adjusted the strap. It tugged at him again, more insistently this time.
"Geryon," Durnik said curiously, "does the orb sometimes glow like that when you're not actually holding the sword?"
Geryon looked over his shoulder at the flaring orb.
"What's it doing that for?" he asked, baffled.
The next tug nearly jerked him off of his feet.
"Grandfather?"
he said, a bit alarmed.
Belgarath's expression grew careful.
"Geryon," he said in a level voice, "I want you to take the sword out of its scabbard. I think the orb is trying to tell you something."
Geryon reached back over his shoulder and drew Iron Grip's great sword from its sheath with a steely slither. Without even stopping to think how irrational it might sound, he spoke directly to the glowing stone on the pommel.
"I'm awfully busy right now. Can't this wait?"
The answer was a steady pull toward the door.
"What is it doing?"
Geryon demanded irritably.
"Let's just follow it," Belgareth told him.
Helplessly, Geryon followed the powerful urging through the door and out into the torchlit corridor. The others trailed curiously along behind him. He could sense the peculiar crystalline awareness of the orb and feel its overwhelming anger. Not since the dreadful night in Tol Mishrak, when he had faced the maimed god of Angorak, had he felt so much outrage emanating from that living stone. The sword continued to pull him down the corridor, moving faster and faster until he was half running to keep up. "What is it trying to do, father?" Polgara asked in a puzzled tone. "It has never done anything like this before."
"I am not sure. We'll just have to follow it and find out. I think it might be important, though."
Kale stopped briefly in front of a sentry posted in the corridor. "Would you go get my brothers?" he asked the man. "Have them come to the royal apartment."
"Yes, sir," the sentry replied with a quick salute.
Geryon stopped at the dark, polished door to the apartment, opened it, and went inside, with the sword still pulling at him. Queen Layla was just in the act of drawing a blanket over the exhausted Adara, who lay asleep on the couch, when she looked up with astonishment.
"What on earth?" she began.
"Hush, Layla," Polgara told her. "Something is happening that we don't quite understand."
Geryon steeled himself and went on into the bedroom. Synedra lay in the bed, tossing and whimpering in her sleep. At her bedside sat Queen Aelina and Beric's wife Meryl. Arianna dozed in a deep chair near the window. He was only able to give the ladies attending his wife the briefest of glances, however, before the sword pulled him on to the nursery, where the sight of the empty cradle wrenched at his heart. The great sword dipped over the cradle, and the orb glowed. Then the stone flickered with a pulsating light for a moment.
"I think I am starting to understand," Belgareth said. "I won't absolutely swear to this, but I think it wants to follow Geryon's trail." "Can it do that?" Durnik asked. "It can do almost anything, and it is totally committed to the Raven Line. Let it go, Geryon. Let's see where it leads you."
In the corridor outside, Cadel's two brothers, Verdan and Bryn, met them. Verdan, the eldest of the three, was as burly as an ox, and Bryn, the youngest, only slightly less so. Both men wore mail shirts and helmets, and had heavy broadswords belted to their sides. "We think that the orb may be trying to lead us to the prince," Cale explained tersely to them. "We might need you two when we find him." Bryn flashed a broad, almost boyish grin.
"We'll have the abductor's head on a pole before nightfall, then."
"Let's not be too hasty about removing heads," Belgareth told him. "I want the answers to some questions first."
"One of you stay with Synedra at all times," Aunt Paul told Queen Layla, who had curiously trailed along behind them. "She will probably wake up sometime this afternoon. Let Arianna sleep for now. Synedra might need her when she awakens."
"Of course, Polgara," the plump queen of Sindaria replied.
"And you," Aunt Paul said firmly to Erend, who was just coming down the hall, "I want you to stay in the royal apartment and do exactly what Layla tells you to do."
"But,"
he started to protest.
"No buts, Erend. What we have to do might be dangerous, and that is something that you haven't quite learned to understand yet."
"All right, Polgara," he said disconsolately. With the orb on the pommel of that massive sword pulling him along, Geryon followed the unseen track of his son's abductor out through one of the side gates with the rest of them close at his heels.
"It seems to want to go toward the mountains," Geryon said. "I thought the trail would lead down into the city."
"Don't think, Geryon," Polgara told him. "Just go where the orb leads you."
The trail led across the meadow, rising steeply behind the citadel, and then into the forest of dark fir and spruce where Geryon and Synedra had often strolled on their summer outings.
"Are you sure it knows where it's going?" Geryon asked as he pushed his way through a tangled patch of undergrowth. "There's no path here at all. I don't think anyone would have come this way."
"It's following some kind of trail, Geryon. Just keep up with it."
They struggled through the thick underbrush for an hour or so. Once a covey of grouse exploded from under Geryon's feet with a heart-stopping thunder of wings.
"I'll have to remember this place," Bryn said to Kale. "The hunting here might be very good."
"We're hunting other game at the moment,"
Keep your mind on your work. When they reached the upper edge of the forest, Geryon stared up at the steep, rock-strewn meadow rising above the timberline.
Is there a pass of any kind through these mountains?
Off to the left of that big peak, Bren replied, pointing. I use it when I go out to hunt wild stags, and the shepherds take their flocks through it to the pastures in the interior valleys.
Verdan added dryly, Also the shepherdesses. Sometimes the game my brother chases doesn't have any horns.
Bren threw a quick, nervous glance at Polgara, and a slow blush mounted into his cheeks.
I have always rather been fond of shepherdesses,
Belgarath noted blandly.
For the most part, they are gentle, understanding girls, and frequently lonely, aren't they, Bryn?
That will do, father, Aunt Paul said primly. It took the better part of the day to go over the pass and through the green meadows lying in the hidden valleys among the mountains beyond. The sun hovered just above the gleaming, almost molten-looking sea on the western side of the isle, when they crested a boulder-covered ridge and started down the long, rocky slope toward the cliffs, and the frothy surf pounding endlessly against the western coast.
Could a ship have landed on this side?
Geryon asked Kale as they went downhill. Kale was puffing noticeably from the strenuous trek across the island, and he mopped his streaming face with his sleeve.
There are a few places where it's possible, Belgarion, if you know what you're doing. It's difficult and dangerous, but it is possible.
Garion's heart sank.
Then he could very well have gotten away.
I had ships out there, Belgarion, Kale said to him. I sent them out as soon as we found out that the prince had been taken. About the only way someone could have gotten all the way across the island to this side in time to sail away before the ships got around here would to be if they could fly.
We've got him then,
the irrepressible Bren exclaimed, loosening his sword in its scabbard and searching the boulder-strewn slope and the brink of the cliffs with a hunter's trained eye.
Hold it a second, Durnick said sharply.
He lifted his head and sniffed at the onshore breeze.
There's somebody up ahead.
What?
Geryon said, a sudden excitement building up in him.
I just got a distinct whiff of somebody who doesn't bathe regularly.
Belgarath's face took on an intense expression.
Paul, he said, why don't you take a quick look down there?
She nodded tersely, and her forehead furrowed with concentration. Geryon felt and heard the whispered surge as she probed the empty-looking terrain ahead. Carex, she said after a moment. About a dozen of them. They're hiding behind those boulders at the edge of the cliffs. They're watching us, planning an ambush.
Carex?
Bren exclaimed.
Why would Carex want to attack us?
They are bear cultists, she told him. And nobody knows why those madmen do anything.
What do we do?
Bren asked in a half whisper.
An ambush always has the advantage, Verdan replied. Unless the person about to be ambushed knows that he's there.
Then it's the other way around. He looked down the slope grimly, his big hand on his sword hilt.
Then we just go down there and spring their trap?
Bren asked eagerly. Kale looked at Belgarath.
What do you think, Ancient One? We have the advantage now. They are going to expect us to be startled when they jump out at us, but we'll be ready for them. We could have half of them down before they realize their mistake.
Belgarath squinted at the setting sun.
Normally, I would say no. These little incidental fights aren't usually very productive, but we're losing the light.
He turned to Aunt Paul.
Is Geryon anywhere in the vicinity?
No, she replied. There is no sign of him.
Belgarath scratched at his beard.
If we leave the Carex there, they're going to follow us. And I don't think I want them creeping along behind, particularly once it gets dark.
His lined old face tightened into a wolfish grin.
All right. Let's indulge ourselves.
Save a few of them, though, Father. I have some questions I'd like answered, and try not to get yourselves hurt, gentlemen. I'm a little tired for surgery today.
No surgery today, Lady Pulgara,
Bren promised. A few funerals, perhaps, but no surgery. She raised her eyes toward the sky.
Alorns, she sighed.
The ambush did not turn out at all as the hidden bear cultist had anticipated. The fur-clad Kerak, who leaped howling at Geryon, was met in mid-air by the flaming sword of the Riven King, and was sheared nearly in two at the waist by the great blade. He fell to the suddenly blood-drenched grass, writhing and squealing. Kale coolly split a charging cultist's head while his brothers fell on the startled attackers and savagely but methodically began to hack them to pieces. One cultist leaped atop a large rock, drawing a bow with his arrow pointed directly at Geryon, but Belgarath made a short gesture with his left hand, and the bowman was suddenly hurled backward in a long, graceful arc that carried him out over the edge of the nearby cliff. His arrow went harmlessly into the air as he fell shrieking toward the foamy breakers 500 feet below.
"Remember, I need a few of them alive,"
Polgara sharply reminded them, as the carnage threatened to get completely out of hand. Kale grunted, then neatly parried the thrust of a desperate Kerak. His big left fist swung in a broad arc, smashing solidly into the side of the Kerak's head, sending him spinning to the turf. Durnik was using his favorite weapon, a stout cudgel perhaps 3 feet long. Expertly, he slapped a cultist's sword out of his hand and cracked him sharply alongside the head. The man's eyes glazed and he tumbled limply to the ground. Belgarath surveyed the fight, selected a likely candidate, and then levitated him about 50 feet into the air. The suspended man was at first apparently unaware of his new location and kept slashing ineffectually at the surrounding emptiness. The fight was soon over. The last crimson rays of the setting sun mingled with the scarlet blood staining the grass near the edge of the cliff, and the ground was littered with broken swords and scraps of bloody bear skin.
"For some reason, that makes me feel better," Geryon declared, wiping his sword on the fallen body of one of the cultists.
The orb, he noted, was also blazing with a kind of fiery satisfaction. Polgara was coolly inspecting a couple of unconscious survivors.
"These two will sleep for a while," she noted, rolling back an eyelid to examine the glazed eye underneath.
"Bring that one down, Father," she said, pointing at the man Belgara had suspended in midair.
"In one piece, if you can manage it. I would like to question him."
"Of course, Paul."
The old man's eyes were sparkling, and his grin very nearly split his face.
"Father, when are you ever going to grow up?"
"Why, Polgara, what a thing to say."
The floating cultist had finally realized his situation and had dropped his sword. He stood trembling on the insubstantial air, with eyes bulging in terror and his limbs twitching violently. When Belgarath gently lowered him to the ground, he immediately collapsed in a quivering heap. The old man firmly grasped him by the front of his fur tunic and hauled him roughly into a half-standing position.
"Do you know who I am?" he demanded, thrusting his face into that of the cringing captive.
"You... I...
do you?"
Belgarath's voice cracked at him like a whip.
"Yes," the man choked. "Then you know that if you try to run away, I will just hang you back up in the air again and leave you there. You know that I can do that, don't you?"
"Yes."
"That won't be necessary, Father," Polgara said coolly. "This man is going to be very cooperative."
"I will say nothing, witch woman,"
the captive declared, though his eyes were still a bit wild.
"Oh, no, my friend," she told him with a chilly little smile. "You will say everything. You will talk for weeks if I need you to."
She gave him a hard stare and made a small gesture in front of his face with her left hand.
"Look closely, friend," she said. "Enjoy every single detail." The bearded bear cultist stared at the empty air directly in front of his face, and the blood drained from his cheeks. His eyes started from his head in horror, and he shrieked, staggering back. Grimly, she made a sort of hooking gesture with her still extended hand, and his retreat stopped instantly. "You can't run away from it, and unless you talk right now, it will stand in front of your face until the day you die."
"Take it away," he begged in an insane shriek. "Please, I'll do anything, anything."
"I wonder where she learned to do that," Belgarath murmured to Geryon. "I could never do it to anybody, and I've tried."
"He will tell you whatever he knows now, Geryon," Polgara said then. "He is aware of what will happen if he doesn't." "What have you done with my son?" Geryon demanded. The prisoner swallowed hard. Then the terrified man straightened defiantly.
"He's far beyond your reach now, King of Rava."
The rage welled up in Geryon again, and without thinking he reached over his shoulder for his sword. "Geryon," Polgara said sharply. The cultist flinched back, his face going pale.
"Your son is alive," he said hastily, and then a smug look crossed his face. "But the next time you meet him, he will kill you."
"What are you talking about?"
"Ulfgar has consulted the oracles. You are not the Riven King. We have awaited for all these centuries. It is the next King of Riva who will unite Aloria and lead us against the kingdoms of the south. It is your son, Belgerion, and he will lead us because he will be raised to share our beliefs."
"Where is my son?" Geryon shouted at him.
"Where you will never find him," the prisoner taunted. "We will raise and nurture him in the true faith, as befits an Elorn monarch, and when he is grown he will come and kill you, and take his crown and his sword and his orb from your usurping hand."
The man's eyes were bulging now, his limbs shaking with a religious ecstasy, and there was foam on his lips.
"You will die by your own son's hand, Belgerion of Riva. And King Geryon will lead all Elorns against the unbelievers of the south, as Balor commanded."
"We are not getting too far with this line of questioning," Belgarath said. "Let me try for a while."
He turned to the wild-eyed captive.
"How much do you know about this Ulfgar?"
"Ulfgar is the Bear Lord, and he has even more power than you, old man."
"Interesting notion," Belgarath murmured. "Have you ever met this master sorcerer, or even seen him, for that matter?"
"Well," the captive hedged.
"I didn't think so. How did you know that he wanted you to come here and abduct Belgerion's son, then?"
The captive bit his lip.
"Answer me!"
"He sent a messenger," the man replied sullenly.
A sudden thought occurred to Geryon. "Was this Ulfgar of yours behind the attempt to kill my wife?"
"Wife?" the cultist sneered.
"No Elon takes a Tonedrin mongrel to wife. You, Iron Grip's heir, should know that better than any man. Naturally, we tried to kill the Tonedrin wench. It was the only way to rid Aloria of the infection you have brought here."
"You're starting to irritate me, friend," Geryon said bleakly. "Don't do that."
"Let's get back to this messenger," Belgarath said. "You say that the baby is where we cannot reach him, but you are still here, aren't you? Could it just possibly be that it was the messenger who was the actual abductor, and that you and your friends are merely underlings?"
The cultist's eyes grew wild, and he looked this way and that like a trapped animal. His limbs began to tremble violently.
"I think we are approaching a question that you don't want to answer, my friend."
It came almost like a blow. There was a wrenching kind of feeling to it, almost as if someone were reaching inside a skull to twist and crush the brain within.
The captive shrieked, gave Belgarath one wild look, then spun, took three quick steps, and hurled himself off the edge of the cliff behind him.
"Question me now!" he shrieked, as he plummeted down into the twilight that was rising out of the dark, angry waters, surging about the rocks at the foot of the cliff. Then, as he fell, Geryon heard peal upon peal of insane laughter fading horribly as the fanatic dropped away from them. Aunt Paul started quickly toward the edge, but Belgarath reached out and took her arm.
"Let him go, Paul. It wouldn't be a kindness to save him now. Someone put something in his mind that crushed out his sanity as soon as he was asked that certain question."
"Who could possibly do that?"
"I don't know, but I am certainly going to find out."
The shrieking laughter, still fading, continued to echo up to where they stood, and then it ended abruptly, far below.